written record. In the process, he branded the moment on his board of legendary feats his double nickel game as he finished with 55. With all that, it was the ending that blew Manhattan's minds. The Knicks kept close, but Jordan had the ball and the game in his hands in the closing seconds as he surveyed the floor and drew what seemed like the entire defense. There, all alone under the basket, was his new teammate, Bill Wennington, ready to make the winning dunk. Afterward, Riley looked as if he'd been gnawing the leg of the scorer's table the entire 48 minutes. "He's the only one in the history of this game that's had the impact that he's had," he conceded. In the interview room, Jordan presented Starks with one last bit of trash. "I think he forgot how to play me," he said, unable to resist another temptation to score. The performance, more than any other single thing, created the impression that somehow, magically, he was ready to pick up where he had left off, that he was ready to simply waltz right into a fourth championship. Perhaps no one fell harder under this sway than Jordan and his coaches and teammates. The record itself buttressed their belief. With Jordan in the lineup, the Bulls rolled through the last weeks of the spring going 13-4, built on 2 6-game winning streaks that sent the atmosphere of the United Center soaring. Brand new when the season opened, the UC, as it would quickly come to be called in Windy City jargon, seemed awkward and foreign to Jordan, who had once vowed never to play there. He relented, of course, but didn't like it and quipped that he'd like to blow it up. That spring, Chicago Stadium sat across the street with a huge hole in its side from the demolition in progress. On game nights, the lights were on inside the old sandstone sarcophagus as if the ghosts of contests past were waiting, like the rest of Chicago, for good friend Michael and his crowd. Jordan, however, was struggling through bouts of very ordinary play, accompanied by tension behind the scenes. "It's a weird thing to play 65 games without someone," Steve Kerr said, looking back in 2012. "And then that person, who just happens to be the most dominant figure in the sport, just shows up, you know, and plays." It was an adjustment period for sure, and we were all giddy. We were all so excited because we knew we had a chance to win again. In their time alone with him, however, the team was adjusting to a new undercurrent of contempt. Kerr was stunned at the way Jordan seized control of the entire team's mental state, for better or worse. "We had no idea," Kerr said. "He was so intense and condescending in many ways. None of us felt comfortable. On a daily basis, he would just dominate practice, not physically, but emotionally and in an intimidating fashion. He was going to make us compete, whether we wanted to or not, you know. There's certain days where it's like, you're an NBA player and you're exhausted. Every team goes through this. There's just days, and you're going to go and get your shots up, but you just need your rest. And Michael doesn't need rest. He doesn't sleep. Even today, he doesn't need rest. And other guys do. And so on those days when people were tired, he would ridicule us and cajole us and, you know, just yell at us. It was tough. It was hard to deal with." To the basketball public, it had all the appeal of a storybook ending. The Bulls finished in fifth place in the Eastern Conference and had no home court advantage in the playoffs. Still, they managed to oust the Charlotte Hornets in 6 games in the first round. Johnny Bock had been hired by the Hornets and sat on their bench, watching the series wistfully. Jordan greeted his old coach warmly. "I would have loved to be there," Bock said years later, looking back, "but it was not to be." Jordan had readily accepted Jackson's account that Krause had necessitated Bock's firing. That and the conflicts with Pippen had served to halt any thawing in his relationship with the GM brought about by the first 3 titles. Chicago's next opponent was the Magic. Horace Grant had joined Shaquille O'Neal in the Magic forecourt, with Anfernee Hardaway, Dennis Scott, and Nick Anderson providing Orlando with athleticism and shooting to go with their power in the post. They had whipped the Bulls in the United Center shortly after Jordan's return. This one would be a decidedly personal series, with Grant eager to give Reinsdorf, Krause, Jackson, and Jordan a good look at what they had, in his mind, always seemed to disrespect. The Bulls played their way to a 91-90 lead in Game 1 in Orlando, but lost on Jordan's 2 late-game turnovers, one a steal by Anderson when all Jordan basically had to do was dribble out the clock, a flashback to his final game in high school. "Number 45 is not number 23, Anderson said afterward, adding that Jordan didn't seem as explosive as he had been before he left for baseball. "We agonized a little bit for him this year when he went through the postseason drama," Jackson said later, "but knowing Michael so well, I put my arm around him after that first game against Orlando when he lost the ball and said, 'As many times as we won behind you, I never expected to see this happen. Let's use it for our tool. Let's use it to build a positive. You're our guy, and don't ever forget that. You never think you'll have to go to Michael and talk about something like that. Jordan refused to speak with the press afterward. He showed up for the next game wearing his old number 23, an unannounced jersey change that drew the Bulls a $25,000 fine from the league. The NBA also enforced its policy that required Jordan to begin addressing the media again. I didn't take that in a harsh way, Jordan would say of Anderson's comment a few days later, when finally forced to talk. I set such a high standard 2 years ago, and in 20 games I haven't lived up to that, and that's what I'm going to be judged on. I have to live up to my own expectations. The Bulls won Game 2 to even the series and take away home court advantage. They fully expected to take control back in the United Center for Game 3. Jordan scored 40, but he took 31 shots and seemed to forget at times that the Bulls had a team offense. Orlando took the critical game, but Jordan trimmed back his shot selection in the fourth game, which allowed Chicago to even the series. Asked about his future, as the reporters and camera crews packed 10 deep around him, he replied, "Everyone has an opinion about Michael Jordan, except Michael Jordan. I came back for this season and next season, and from that point on we have to evaluate it." From there, he missed shots, made miscues, and watched Grant's play shift the series. Jackson had decided to double-team O'Neal while leaving Grant unguarded, figuring that if Grant made shots, they would only be two-pointers. It backfired. Grant answered Jackson's strategy by scoring early and often, which emphasized a Chicago weakness at power forward. The Magic closed out the series 4-2 on the Bulls' home floor, and Orlando's young players hoisted Grant to their shoulders and carried him off in celebration. In the hallway outside, the Bulls' coaching staff seemed numb with disbelief. "Nick Anderson was right," Tex Winter confided. "Michael isn't the same player." "He's aged like everybody else has aged," Jackson agreed later, "but he's still Michael Jordan." Jackson predicted that Jordan would regain his touch and shoot better than 50% for the next season. "You can bet your bottom dollar on that," the coach said. "Will he break through all the defenses that people bring at him? The double teams and triple teams? No, but he'll probably start knowing where to pass the ball better." Michael lost perspective of where the passing would have to come from a lot of times. Jordan had needed the team building of a full 82-game schedule, Jackson said, looking back some weeks later. He saw and heard the criticism that went on in the postseason. There was a lot of the blame game going on in Chicago, a lot of people whining and gnashing teeth. Michael is going to use that for his strength. "It was a profoundly humbling moment for Jordan," Steve Kerr recalled in 2012. "He gets the ball stolen from him at half court by Nick Anderson. We had the game won. We lose that series. He had some phenomenal games and some very poor games. So I always thought it was the failure of the playoffs that drove him. But I think baseball had to figure in there too, because his last title was in 93, so he goes 2 full years without feeling like he's on top of the world." Failing his team had bruised his outsized pride. For years he had taken the Bulls' fortunes on his shoulders and lifted them with brilliant performances in front of millions of adoring witnesses. Now, it was his fall that was on display. Chapter 32. Training Camp. Michael Jordan's much-heralded return had served to reveal mostly what he didn't know. He hadn't really known vulnerability, at least not on a basketball court. "The game taught me a lesson in the disappointing series I had last year," he would admit that fall. "It pushed me back into the gym to learn the game all over again." Fans and media naturally shifted the blame elsewhere, onto Chicago's offense. In the days following the loss, the sports talk shows in the city buzzed over the possibility that the triangle no longer worked for the Bulls. Even Tex Winter himself harbored doubts and badly wanted to know Jordan's thoughts on the issue. With his impulsiveness, Jackson recalled, Tex said, "Phil, I'd like you to ask him, does he think we need to change the offense? Can we play this triple post offense? Is it something we should plan on using next year? I want you to ask him just for me." "So I did," and Michael said, "The triple post offense is the backbone of this team. It's our system, something that everybody can hang their hat on, so that they know where to go and how to operate." By that time, Michael had won 3 championships playing the triangle, so he had complete trust in the offense and in Phil, Steve Kerr explained. "You know, Phil could tell us in practice repeatedly, he'd say, 'I don't run the triangle for Michael or Scotty. Those guys will score no matter what offense we run. I run this for the rest of you guys.' He would say that in front of Michael, and I think that was smart, because everyone knows, in some ways, that offense was restricting Michael's abilities. If the goal was to try to get him 40 points, we could have just run plays for him and cleared out for him, and he could have gotten 40 points. But we weren't going to win that way, and Michael knew that already. Far more than the offense, the team's future still hinged on a nagging question about Jordan himself. What if he up and quit again? It seemed pretty clear to some observers that his time as the game's dominant player had passed. There was even speculation about some Bulls staff members that he might retire again rather than deal with the hassles of NBA life. This speculation intensified over the summer as Jordan became involved in the battle over a collective bargaining agreement between the NBA and its players. He had never shown the slightest interest in league labor issues and had determined never to seek to renegotiate his contract with the Bulls. Yet, here he was, at the urging of David Falk, taking a leadership role in a renegade effort to decertify the players' union and force the league into giving its players a better deal with more freedom to negotiate. The issue was eventually resolved, but it left the impression of a new Jordan, more aggressive in off-court issues. Despite the public anxiety over his and the team's future, the Bulls' coaching staff remained quietly upbeat about their prospects. They saw that Orlando's talented young team would be the main contender in the Eastern Conference, and if the Bulls hoped to win another championship, they would have to match up with the Magic. Chicago needed to find a power forward to strengthen their post play and to find bigger guards to counter Orlando's trio of Anfernee Hardaway, Nick Anderson, and Brian Shaw. Krause's first move was to leave fan favorite B.J. Armstrong unprotected in the upcoming expansion draft. A bigger guard to replace Armstrong was already on the roster, former All-Star Ron Harper, whom Krause had signed in 1994 to help fill the void created by Jordan's retirement. A series of knee injuries had precipitated a decline in Harper's athleticism since his days as a young superstar with the Cleveland Cavaliers. He had been frustrated with the triangle offense, but Jackson persuaded him that if he improved his conditioning, he would be a factor for the coming season. Likewise, Jordan needed to retool both his mindset and his workouts in order to replace what Reinsdorf called his baseball body with a leaner basketball body. Jordan was scheduled to spend the summer months in Hollywood making the animated Bugs Bunny film Space Jam with Warner Brothers. Surprisingly, the Bulls coaches weren't worried about their main player spreading himself too thin in this new age of vulnerability. "We didn't worry about Michael," Winter said. "We figured Michael could take care of himself." For the most part, his gym would be a temporary floor in the Hollywood studio he occupied while making his film. There, Jordan could work on his game, yet be within reach of the film crew when he was needed to shoot a scene. For years, Krause had encouraged Jordan to make a greater effort at weightlifting, but Dean Smith had never been a fan of bulking up his players, an influence that had resonated with Jordan. The more Krause talked about weightlifting, it seemed the more Jordan scoured the landscape for open tee times. But Orlando had gotten his attention. Krause had long wanted Jordan to work with team weightlifting director Al Vermeil, the brother of former Philadelphia Eagles coach Dick Vermeil. But Jordan eyed suspiciously anything suggested by the GM. Instead, he turned to Tim Grover, Juanita Jordan's personal trainer. Jordan, Harper, and Pippen worked out every morning with Grover, referring to this group as the Breakfast Club. In time, the Bulls would come to be considered one of the best conditioned teams in the history of the game, and Grover would soon be in top demand as the guru who guided the rebuilding of MJ's body. "I've never seen anybody work harder than Michael Jordan," Grover said that fall. He fulfilled his normal summer obligations, shooting commercials, making some personal appearances, and he shot a movie. But his conditioning program always remained his primary objective. For Jordan, the torturous off-season program was just the beginning of a year-long effort to regain his earlier dominance in the NBA. As he neared his 33rd birthday, he tried to prepare himself to face not only the game's talented young players, but the specter of his own youth. "I'm the kind of person who thrives on challenges," Jordan explained at the time, "and I took pride in people saying I was the best player in the game. But when I left the game, I fell down in the ratings. Down, I feel, below people like Shaquille O'Neal, Hakeem Olajuwon, Scottie Pippen, David Robinson, and Charles Barkley. That's why I committed myself to going through a whole training camp, playing every exhibition game, and playing every regular season game. At my age, I have to work harder. I can't afford to cut corners. So this time, I planned to go into the playoffs with a whole season of conditioning under my belt. He needed to keep playing that summer, even as he spent long days on the film lot. Jordan arranged to set up a court and invited an array of NBA players to join him for pickup games between takes on the set. He had great fun with the summer competition. But by the time he wrapped the film, packed up and headed back to Chicago for training camp, his focus was sheathed in an inexplicable fury. It would be woe unto anyone who stepped in his way. The anger. The first time Jim Stack suggested the idea, Jerry Krause ignored him. He knew Jordan and Pippen would go nuts if they brought Dennis Rodman anywhere near the Bulls. And Jerry Reinsdorf? They all hated the Pistons, the thug-assed bad boys. But Stack was pretty sure it would work. Jim Stack came to me early in the summer and asked me to look at Rodman, Krause said. When I put him off, he finally pleaded with me. He talked me into finding out if all the bad things we had heard were true. Without Jim's persistence, we wouldn't have looked behind all the rumors to see what the truth was. The deeper they investigated Rodman, the more Krause became intrigued. Friends, enemies, former coaches, former teammates, the Bulls contacted a wide variety of people about Rodman. Chuck Daly told him he would come to play and play hard. Krause still hesitated. Everybody in the league was scared to death of Dennis, said Brendan Malone, the former Detroit assistant. Reinsdorf was likewise cautious. Take it slow. A guy like that could wreck everything in a matter of days. Rodman himself couldn't believe it when he was first contacted, but Krause realized about halfway through their conversations that he liked the guy. Satisfied, Krause sent Rodman to speak with Jackson, who spent hours trying to read his attitude. Clearly, Rodman wanted to join the Bulls to play with Jordan. He even allowed the team to talk to a psychiatrist he had been seeing. The staff figured Pippen and Jordan would be a very tough sell, but the two of them thought it over. If he's ready and willing to play, it will be great for our team, Pippen said. But if he's going to be a negative to us, I don't think we need that. We could be taking a huge step backwards. Once Jordan and Pippen agreed, Krause traded longtime backup center Will Perdue to San Antonio for Rodman in early October, just days before training camp opened. And like that, Dennis the Worm Rodman, the NBA's 34-year-old adolescent, became a Chicago Bull. He was looking for a 2 or 3 year deal in the neighborhood of $15 million. I'll put $5 million in the bank, live off the interest, and party my ass off, he told reporters, which, as time would reveal, is exactly what he did. In recent seasons, the Bulls had come to rely on a trio of centers, Will Perdue, Bill Wennington, and Luke Longley. Perdue could block shots, Wennington had a feathery offensive touch, and Longley, at 7'2 and 290 pounds, had the huge body to go against giant forces like Shaquille O'Neal. None of the three Chicago centers constituted a complete force on his own, but collectively they formed what the press had taken to calling a three-headed monster, a patchwork solution assembled by the coaches. Perdue would be traded, and Rodman would be the power forward that helped out the surviving two-headed monster at center. For help in handling Rodman, the team signed his teammate from San Antonio, Jack Haley, and then brought in another former bad boy, James Edwards, to help out with the center chores. Later they would add yet another former Piston big man, John Sally, all as part of their Rodman plan. The Bulls coaches figured that with Jordan back full-time and committed to winning a championship, with Pippen, Longley, and Kukoc maturing, with Harper refurbishing his game, and with Rodman in town, they had just about all of the major pieces in place. The Bulls had long hated the bad boys, but now they were set to deploy a slew of them. The only problem would be making it work. Rodman arrived in Chicago with his hair dyed Bulls red, with a black bull in the crown, and his nails done in a layered Bulls motif. I understand that they're a little leery and a little cautious of having someone like me in here, he said. They wonder how I will respond to the team. I guess they'll find out in training camp and during the preseason. I think Michael knows he can pretty much count on me doing a good job. I hope Scotty feels the same way. The wild saga of Jordan's return had finally calmed in Chicago, but now the city found itself engaged in the next media whipsaw, the introduction of the Worm. Who could have foreseen that the Bulls fan base would fall so instantly and completely in love with the tattooed man? He arrived in town on the verge of bankruptcy, and soon had a fistful of endorsement contracts and cash to throw around. Throughout its history, the city of broad shoulders had seen a steady parade of gangsters and curious madams, crooked politicians, and honorable shysters, but Rodman was easily one of the most colorful customers Rush Street had ever known. As Jackson would soon note, his new forward was a clown of the first order. After all, who could fail to notice a guy who showed up for a press conference in a wedding dress? If it hadn't been for his grand entrance, fans might have realized that a bizarre, almost hellish training camp was unfolding that fall. It would take years for the truth to leak out about what really happened in those long, foreboding days at the Berto Center. When it was over, the Bulls rolled out of the station like a trainload of parolees, as frightened as they were frightening. "I got a glimpse of it right away," Steve Kerr recalled in 2012. Camp was insane. How competitive and intense it was. Michael was coming off the comeback when he hadn't played that well in the playoffs, at least as far as his standards were concerned. He was out to prove a point and get his game back in order. So every practice was like a war. If Dennis Rodman had any thought about acting up, he ditched it immediately away. Jordan was that intimidating. In fact, Rodman didn't even speak to his new teammates, preferring instead to work in a silence that would grow stranger with each passing day. It was a tough training camp because everybody was guarded, Jack Haley would explain later in the season. Again, you're Michael Jordan, you're Scottie Pippen. Why would you have to go over to Dennis? Michael Jordan made $50 million last year. Why would he have to go over and basically kiss up to some guy to get him to talk? They came over and shook his hand and welcomed him to the team and this and that. But other than that, it was a slow process. "I think everybody was skeptical of what might happen," recalled John Paxson, who had been hired as an assistant coach. "But we were also optimistic as to what could happen. The optimism stemmed from Phil's personality. We felt that if there was anyone around the league who could get along with Dennis and get Dennis to respect him as a coach, it would be Phil." Central to the uneasiness about team chemistry was the relationship between Rodman and Pippen. "No, I have not had a conversation with Dennis," Pippen acknowledged early in the year. "I've never had a conversation with Dennis in my life, so I don't think it's anything new now." It was a blessing, in retrospect, that the Rodman sideshow served to obscure what was really happening in training camp. Jordan was even more difficult than he had been the previous spring. He was far more strident in his relationships with his teammates upon his return from retirement. When he came back after the murder, he was a different animal, Lacey Banks explained. The team, after all, had been rebuilt while Jordan was away from the game. There was little question that he found himself working with a group who had no real idea how to win a championship. "A lot of these guys have come from programs who have never experienced the stages of being a champion," Jordan explained in acknowledging his rough approach with new teammates. "I'm just speeding up the process." Another factor had been that summer's lockout. At Falk's bidding, Jordan had led the failed effort to decertify the union, with Steve Kerr on the other side of the issue. Reinsdorf had opposed Jordan being out front on the issue, but he did it anyway. "We had an underlying edge from the lockout," Kerr recalled, "and I was the Bulls player rep, and Michael was one of David Falk's guys, and they weren't happy at all with the union leadership, so there was kind of an undercurrent of that." Every drill, every practice was so intense. Kerr sensed an extra level of irritation, perhaps even dislike, from Jordan. "It did not seem racial in any way," he recalled with a laugh. "He never used race in any comment. He was above that. He didn't discriminate. He just pretty much destroyed all of us. But I think it was calculated for sure. He tested every guy. You may not have known it at the time, but he was testing you, and you had to stand up to him." Kerr's time to stand up came on the third day of training camp. "This is what I remember," he recalled in 2012. "We had a scrimmage, and the starters were beating up on us. We were the red team, and they were getting away with fouling. Michael was just being incredibly physical. And Phil had left to go up to his office. He had to go tend to a phone call or something. And so Phil's absence definitely led to a situation where it was a little out of control. Michael was talking all kinds of shit. It really is kind of a blur as to what he was saying. But I got really fed up, you know, because I felt like they were fouling every time and Michael was fouling. The assistant coaches are reffing and they don't want to call a foul on Michael. He's talking and I start talking back." "I'm not sure anyone had done that before," he said with a laugh. Kerr got the ball, and Jordan again fouled him. "He was guarding me, and I think I used my off arm and threw an elbow or something to get him off of me, and he kept talking. Then I'm yapping, and the next play, I'm running through the lane, and he gives me a forearm shiver in the middle of the lane, and I give him one back. And he basically came after me. As Judd Bushler says, it was like a velociraptor. I was like the kid in Jurassic Park who got attacked by the velociraptor. I had no chance. It was just mayhem. We were screaming at each other, and our teammates, thank God, they all ran in and pulled us apart. But I ended up with a black eye. Apparently, I got punched. I don't even remember getting hit. It was the first and only fistfight in Kerr's life. We were barking at each other, and it got out of hand, recalled Kerr, the son of a career diplomat. He was just letting us know how they were kicking our ass. I knew they were kicking our ass. He didn't have to tell me about it. Why wouldn't that piss me off? It's natural. Other guys were pissed off too. He just happened to be guarding me at the time. Jackson saw the incident as a serious and immediate threat to the team's chemistry. Michael stormed out of practice, Kerr said, and Phil came down and came over to talk to me. He said, "You and Michael have to patch things up. You gotta talk to him, and you gotta patch it up." I got home, and there was a message on my phone, on my answering machine, from Michael, and he apologized. And it was weird. It was like from that day forward, our relationship was great. Like, you know, a few days after that, where it was a little weird just because of what had happened, but clearly he accepted me from that point on. With that one incident, Jordan had assumed complete control of the team. Where before he had used his anger and mental intimidation to push the group, he now added the implied threat of violence. He had created an atmosphere that for the next three seasons would allow him to drive the Bulls at the pace he set. He wasn't alone in this effort. He formed a partnership with Jackson, the team's other dominant personality, to create a fiercely disciplined group. It was why Jackson referred to Jordan as the alpha male. Jackson sought to temper and direct Jordan's fierceness with Zen teachings, mindfulness, meditation, and other practices. He didn't articulate much on a personal level, Kerr said of Jordan's approach. He articulated plenty on a basketball level. I mean, he had his opinions. In the film sessions, he would talk all the time, and Phil would sometimes ask him to talk. So he exerted his influence on us through the game, but not so much on a personal level. This unprecedented approach was at its most extreme in that first training camp after Jordan's return. But the dynamic continued for three very successful, very turbulent seasons, Kerr said. He knows he intimidates people, Jackson would say that fall. I had to pull him in last year when he first came back. He was comfortable playing with Will Perdue. He was tough on Longley. He would throw passes that at times I don't think anybody could catch, then glare at him and give him that look. And I let him know that Luke wasn't Will Perdue, and it was all right if he tested him out to see what his mettle was. But I wanted him to play with him because he had a big body. He wasn't afraid. He'd throw it around. And if we were going to get by Orlando, we were going to have somebody to stand up to Shaquille O'Neal. Jackson, who had always made an effort to keep the team's hierarchy clear, now had Jordan as his enforcer. The team had help from Tex Winter, who also had a harsh way of going after players if they slacked off. The Zen. Jackson had brought in George Mumford, a psychologist and mindfulness expert, who taught the players to meditate and do togetherness exercises. Mumford also counseled individual players to help them grasp the team dynamic, which consisted in part of Jordan bullying them and Jackson using his influence to keep everybody on board. What was remarkable was to see Jordan come to embrace Jackson's softer efforts with the team, Kerr pointed out. That was the key to the whole thing. If Michael hadn't trusted Phil, it never would have worked for any of us. But Michael had such great respect for Phil that he embraced those methods. It often felt incongruous that Jackson would use 30 minutes of precious practice time to have his players sit on the floor and meditate in the dark, only to face Jordan's wrath as soon as the drill started. As Kerr said, Jackson told them that he didn't run the triangle offense for Jordan, but for the rest of the players. The meditation seemed to fit a similar but converse pattern. The coach didn't really have meditation so much for the rest of the players. He had it in hopes that it might prevent Jordan from chewing up one promising teammate after another. In short time, Jordan gained a level of trust with Mumford and told the psychologist that if he'd met him earlier in his career, he might not have spent his life as a prisoner in his hotel room. Pippen also helped enforce the hierarchy. He could flash his anger, but was an understanding and compassionate leader. He had graduated from MJ's School of Hard Knocks, and by the fall of 1995, Pippen and Jordan acted as partners at the heart of the team, Kerr observed. By the time I got there, they had a great relationship. You know, they had their breakfast club where Harper and Pippen would go over to Michael's house and lift weights in the morning. They would go lift weights and then show up to practice together. Those three were really tight, and it was the perfect role for Scotty, as we all know, not having to be the man, but being able to dominate in his own way. Jordan was still the alpha male, but his pairing with Pippin had created a two-man unit in which the sum was far greater than the individual parts. They were a perfect combination at both ends, Kerr explained. They were both so versatile defensively, they could just switch and cause so much havoc. And then offensively, Scotty really preferred to pass, and Michael preferred to score. By the end, I think one of our last championships, Michael basically pulled him under his arm and announced to the crowd that it wouldn't have been possible without Scotty. So in the end, it was an incredible relationship. It was in this atmosphere that Dennis Rodman was injected into Chicago's most unusual team chemistry. Everyone on the inside was eager to see how he would fit into a new hierarchy and identity that fall. They hardly ever spoke, Kerr said of Rodman and Jordan. There was just this respect, this underlying respect that you felt. It was real easy to feel it, because Michael never picked on Dennis. Never. And Dennis was like subservient to Michael in an emotional way, not in a physical way. He never did anything for Michael that he didn't do for the rest of us, but there was just this understanding that Michael is the greatest and I'm below him, and so I'm not going to mess with him and vice versa. It was really interesting. The primary target of Jordan's fury would remain the team's foreign-born stars, Luke Longley from Australia and Tony Kukoc from Croatia. By all accounts, including Jordan's, his treatment of them was harsh, and it lasted over his final three seasons in Chicago. Those guys were so talented, particularly Tony, who was incredibly gifted, Kerr said. And Luke was a huge piece, literally and figuratively. I mean, we needed him to man the paint and anchor the defense and rebound, and you had to light a fire under Luke to get the best out of him. So I think there was a reason that Michael and Phil and Tex and Scotty all stayed on those guys. It was because they needed it. They needed the kick in the pants. I think Tony was just so laid back. I'm very laid back on the surface, but you can get to me. And I have a button that can be pushed, especially when I was playing. I could get so angry, like I did that day, that I could snap. I never saw Tony snap, though. I never saw Luke snap. And so it was like they were just fair game for Michael. Tex Winter had seen every sort of team dynamic, but was transfixed by the evolution of Jordan after his return. It's another way he has of challenging himself, the older coach theorized, pointing out that if Jordan was so hard on his teammates, it allowed him little room for personal letdowns. Kerr agreed. If you look at his past, it's filled with moments of sort of created challenges for himself to raise his level. The thing that amazes me is that the standards he has set are so unbelievably high that it's almost unfair that he has to maintain them. It's incredible. Every arena that we go into all season long, he's expected to get 40 points. He loves it. That's the amazing thing about him. The combination of incredible talent, work ethic, basketball skills, and competitiveness. It's just an unbelievable combination. Looking back 2 years later, Jordan would acknowledge that he had sometimes come down so hard that he had run people off. You have a better understanding for me as a leader if you have the same motivation, the same understanding for what we're trying to achieve and what it takes to get there, he explained. Now, if you and I don't get along, certainly you won't understand the dedication it takes to win. So if I run him off, I don't run them off with the intention of running them off. I run them off with the intention of having them understand what it takes to be a champion, what it takes to dedicate yourself to winning. I'm not hard every single day. I mean, there are days where you have to relax and let the tension flow or ease. But for the most part, when you have to focus, you have to focus. As a leader, that's what I have to do. And I'm not by myself, he emphasized, echoing Kerr. Pip does the same, and Phil does the same. But I do it more consistently, I guess, because I've been here the longest. I feel obligated to make sure that we maintain the same type of expectations, the same level. Jordan knew intimidation well, having taken a beating from the Pistons, and it would have to be taught to others. He had made that decision in 1990, when he had laid his heart on the line and realized afterward that his teammates hadn't done the same. He would not find himself in battle again with faint hearts around him, he decided. That's going through the fucking stages of being on a losing team to a championship team, he said in retrospect. His eyes narrow as he frowned. Jordan had grabbed the team by the throat to elevate its emotional level. Just the realization of that had staggered Steve Kerr. So this is what it is, he said to himself. Jordan readily acknowledged that his status in pro basketball allowed him to do things that perhaps no other player, probably no coach even, could get away with. You don't want to do it in a way that they misinterpret the relationship, he said. It's nothing personal. I love all my teammates. I would do anything. I would extend myself to make sure they're successful, but they have to do the same. They have to have a better understanding of what it takes. The fact that Jordan occasionally chased some would-be teammates off may be a good thing, Kerr said. You've got to kind of weed out the people who can't really help out. And Michael has a way of finding those guys, finding weaknesses. Obviously, we all have weaknesses, Kerr added and laughed. Except for Michael. And what he does, he forces us to fight and be competitive. To fight through those weaknesses and not accept them, to work on them and to improve ourselves. Make no mistake though, Kerr said. What Jordan did was pure challenge. There was not a whole lot of encouragement. I suspect that Larry Bird was the same way, said trainer Chip Schaefer. And I know from observing countless Lakers practices during my time at Loyola Marymount that Magic Johnson was a bitch at practice. You drop one of his passes, you miss a layup, you miss an assignment on defense. Man, if eyes could kill, that's the way it was. It would take time for this harsher Jordan to gain focus in the public mind. Bruce Levine, a reporter for a Chicago sports radio station, had gotten to know Jordan well over the years. Slowly, Levine saw what James Jordan's death had meant for the star. Up until then, he was the most unaffected superstar, because he wouldn't allow things to get to him, Levine explained at the time. He would still sit in the locker room before the game and stretch out with us, and talk for a half hour or 40 minutes about everything but basketball. He would stretch out on the floor, and we would just sit for 45 minutes and talk about everything. We'd have fun. He'd ask questions. He's very inquisitive. A guy who wanted to learn about things. He was still learning about life and educating himself. But once the situation occurred with his father, and the way the media portrayed that funeral, he never had the same feeling for the media again. He distrusts most media, even people like myself who are peripherally friends with him. It just changed. He became hardened by it to a certain extent. He's still very gracious with his time, but the fun kind of went out of it for him and for us. What made Jordan's harshness so difficult to read was that it often came wrapped in the mirth of his trash talk. Michael has made up his mind that he's going to enjoy his time of playing basketball, Tex Winter observed. I think he made his mind up a long time ago. He enjoys playing, and he wants to keep it fun and loose, and that's what he attempts to do. His methods, sometimes in my mind, are questionable. But if that's what it takes for him to enjoy himself and to challenge himself, then so be it. It remained Jackson's job to integrate his new, harsher version of Jordan into the roster. Since Jordan's return, the coach had continued to remind him that the team was only as strong as its weakest link, which had precipitated the fiery training camp. The coach's bag of tricks included the mind game, the deceit, the motivational hide-and-seek, and, when necessary, the rare frank assessment or even confrontation. As their time together went on, the nature of Jackson's effort became more political, more soothing and understanding. The respect he showed Jordan presented an obvious double standard, however. Phil would make references to things with Michael as, "We need to do this," backup center Bill Wennington observed one day after a game. Whenever there was a problem with Michael in a meeting, it was like, "We need to do this." If it was me, it was like, "Bill, you have to go box out." When it was a Michael thing, it was a "we" thing. For us, it was, "Steve, you need to take that shot." Michael would maybe miss a box out, and it was like, "Well, we need to box out now." Just little things like that. But if you understand the reason for it, and the reason that the team was good, it's all part of it. Jordan had long accused Jackson of playing mind games, but he played them as well, only far more harshly. "That's what it is, mental," Jordan said. "You gotta force them to think. This team is not a physical team. We don't have physical advantages. We have mental advantages." They were vicious, Kerr said of Jordan's particular brand of mind games. But the good thing was we had to deal with them in practice. But we knew that our opponents had to deal with them every game. Muggsy Bogues could confirm that. At a key point during the 95 playoff series between the Bulls and Charlotte Hornets, Jordan backed off of the 5'3" Bogues and told him, "Shoot it, you fucking midget." Bogues missed the shot, lost his confidence, and later reportedly told Johnny Bock that the play started his career down the path to ruination. Friend or foe, Jordan knew how to get through to those around him on a deeply psychological level. Chicago sports broadcaster Jim Rose gained rare insight to this once when he played in a charity basketball game with Jordan against several other NBA stars. Rose had covered the team and knew of Jordan's competitive demands, so the broadcaster spent weeks practicing for the game. But during the game, he blew a layup, which sparked Jordan's fury. "You're not black enough," Jordan supposedly barked at Rose, deeply offending the broadcaster, so much so that Rose immediately fired the ball at Jordan. Jordan later apologized, but the incident revealed how intuitive he was in knowing which buttons to push to get through emotionally to his teammates. "He did it all in good fun," Rose said, Michael doesn't like to lose at all. I missed the layup. I got mad and threw the ball at him and stormed off the court. Michael doesn't have a mean bone in his body. He's a wonderful person, but there are some times when his competitiveness takes over. Jim Stack often found himself marveling at the gap between the Jordan that the public adored and the often ugly, domineering figure of Chicago practices. Nike helped create that image for him, Stack observed, adding that there was substantial truth to what the public saw. Michael was raised well. James and Dolores did a hell of a job. But when he was in his competitive mode, he could flip the switch and keep it there. Off the court, he was one of the most engaging, charismatic figures of all time. I put him up there with Muhammad Ali in that category. He was engaging and respectful and knew the right things to say. But when you flipped that competitive switch with him, he'd rip your heart out. Part 10. Fury. Chapter 33. The Carnival. Having been chastised and assaulted and terrorized, the Bulls emerged from training camp turbocharged, and Dennis Rodman, with his multi-hued head bobbing up and down, was much more than a hood ornament. His energy and enthusiasm alone made the team instantly better. The way he collected offensive rebounds in bunches almost made shooting percentages irrelevant. His teammates seemed assured that if they happened to miss a shot, the crazy fist-pumping worm would come up with the ball for another shot. He drove the point home with 10 rebounds in the first preseason game. Once he gets a little more familiar with everybody out on the floor, and there's more continuity, he's going to start to shine, Jordan cautiously predicted. Jackson saw much the same. The very first preseason game of the year, Jack Haley recalled, Dennis goes in the game. Dennis throws the ball up in the stands and gets a delay of game foul, and yells at the official, gets a technical foul. The first thing I do is I look down the bench at Phil Jackson to watch his reaction. Phil Jackson chuckles, leans over to Jimmy Clemens, our assistant coach, and says, God, he reminds me of me. The United Center crowds become infatuated with his pogo stick approach to the game, and were rewarded at the end of each contest with Rodman hurling his sweat-soaked jersey to the fans, after which he would prance bare-chested to the locker room. Female fans responded in kind. Whenever he would venture into bars across the city, women seemed compelled to lift their shirts and show him their breasts. The season seemed destined to take Chicagoland to new and different places. Until that time, Rodman had acted as if there were no limits, but Jordan's presence instantly provided them. The media went on and on about how Phil Jackson would handle Rodman, but Jackson could relax because Jordan provided all the presence that any coach would ever need. Lacey Banks loved to make predictions, some of which had forced him to eat crow over the years. During the preseason that fall, he predicted the Bulls would win 70. As if on cue, Jordan went for 42 points against the Charlotte Hornets in an opening night win at the United Center, setting in motion an epic momentum. Unfortunately, the opening game would also feature an ugly confrontation between Juanita Jordan and her husband's family as they shared a skybox. Juanita was entertaining her family and friends in one part of the skybox, while the Jordans gathered and enjoyed each other's company in a way that apparently offended Juanita. Sis recalled their surprise when her brother's wife angrily lashed out at them at the end of the evening. There must be some mistake, Dolores Jordan and her children thought. But the next morning, Michael made an angry phone call to his mother and cursed her out. He expressed resentment that the family had encroached on his peace of mind. While the exact nature of the conflict was unclear, it appeared to be as much a matter of accumulated conflict as anything. The episode would mark a period of Jordan's estrangement from his mother and siblings. At one point, he changed the locks on the offices of the James R. Jordan Foundation to bar her access. Further tension built behind the scenes as his brother Larry began developing a plan for a Jordan cologne. While aware of his brother's activities, Michael had begun working with established perfume industry intermediaries through his agents to develop his own line. Michael eventually informed his brother of his plans, but only after Larry had spent substantial time and money developing the idea. The older brother was crushed by the news, and Dolores Jordan grew furious with her famous son. Michael offered his brother a role in the cologne product, but that apparently did little to ease the hard feelings in the family that had been building since James Jordan's death. Clearly, however, Michael Jordan had learned his lesson from the Flight 23 stores fiasco, He did not want to be in business with family. Private dramas like these, along with the murder trials of the two men charged with James Jordan's killing, formed much of the backdrop of the magical 1995-96 NBA season. The trial, motions, and deliberations ran for months, concluding in March with the convictions and life sentences for the two killers. For the most part, the sports media respected Jordan's desire not to speak about the proceedings, so the harsh circumstances of the case played out for months on the news pages, juxtaposed against the ongoing celebration of the Bulls' spectacular season. In his tirade with his mother, Jordan had vented months of anger and frustration. From an early age, Jordan had always loved his family, but it would become increasingly clear that the young men who killed his father stole precious things from Jordan himself in the process. The families of murder victims are deeply, profoundly changed by the experience, and often find it difficult to identify with anyone, even family members, in the aftermath. Jordan's father had been gone 2 years, an important period in the grieving process, but much conflict remained. Steve Kerr's own father, an educator at the American University of Beirut, had been assassinated by terrorists when Kerr was a freshman at the University of Arizona. Jordan knew that the two of them shared something that no one else on the team had faced, yet never once in their years together did they discuss this. Jordan was leading the most public of lives while walking one of the most difficult private paths that any person could take. Even from his teammates, he kept it very close, Kerr said. I would say in 5 years of playing with Michael, we probably shared just a handful of meals together, and I'm not talking about team meals or meals on the plane. I mean, like, going out at night with the team and having dinner. Michael would stay in his suite every night. He was a prisoner of his own life. Once or twice a year, we'd end up at the same restaurant at the same table with 5, 6 of our teammates. But I never had just a breakfast, just the two of us, or lunch, just the two of us. It just never happened, because of the world that he lived in. Every single other teammate, I shared very quiet moments where you could discuss things, intimate things. But I never, ever even had a chance to bring anything like that up with Michael, because, even though he was the leader of the team, the dominant presence on the team, he was always a little bit apart from the rest of us too. There was little time to process the situation with the most extraordinary of seasons upon them. One relief available on a Jackson-Jordan team was that the hierarchy quickly fell in place. At center, Longley seemed eager to face the challenge of being a starter, and Wennington was comfortable in his role as a backup. And 39-year-old James Edwards, the former Piston, gave them further depth at the post. It was kind of weird going there after all those battles we had with those guys, recalled Edwards, who was also curious to see how Jordan received Rodman. But Michael seemed to have a lot of respect for Dennis. As long as he did what he was supposed to do on the court, that was all that Michael was concerned about. Krause had also brought in guard Randy Brown to work with Kerr as backcourt reserves. Coming off the bench were Judd Bushler, Dickie Simpkins, and first-round draft pick Jason Caffey out of the University of Alabama. The other factor in the mixture was Tony Kukoc's reluctance to play the sixth man or third forward. He wanted to start, but his role in the lineup had gone to Rodman. Yet no sooner had Rodman started to settle in with the Bulls than a calf muscle injury sidelined him for a month. Even so, they rolled out to 5 straight wins, the best start in team history. If the early success did anything to make the Bulls complacent, the Orlando Magic snapped them back to attention in the sixth game, just as the Bulls were breaking in their new black with red pinstripe road uniforms. Orlando guard Penny Hardaway outplayed Jordan, giving the Magic a key home victory. The Bulls responded with 2 quick wins back in Chicago before scorching through a Western road trip, winning 6 of 7 games. The trip opened in Dallas, where Chicago needed overtime and 36 from Jordan, including 6 of the Bulls' final 14 points, to win 108-102. This is a very aggressive basketball club and very confident, Jackson said afterward. I think people are surprised who we are, or are surprised how we are playing, or they're not comfortable with our big guard rotation. It is giving us some easy offensive opportunities, so we are getting going early. They finished the Western road swing in early December with Jordan scoring 37 in a win over the Los Angeles Clippers. I feel I'm pretty much all the way back now as a player, he said, reflecting on the first month of the season. My skills are there, so is my confidence. Now it's just a matter of me going out and playing the way I'm capable every night. In his years before baseball, Jordan had shot a stellar 5-16 from the floor, but the numbers dipped to just 441 during his 17-game run over the spring of 1995. Now he was up to 493. His scoring, too, was headed back up to a 30-point average from the 9-year low of 26.9 in 1995. Lacy Banks put together a comparison, showing that if Jordan played through the 1998 season, he would rest third on the all-time scoring list with almost 29,000 points, behind only Wilt Chamberlain and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the all-time leader with 38,397. Banks asked him about going for the all-time record. "Forget Jabbar," Jordan replied. "No way do I plan to play anywhere close to 20 years. He's right where I knew he'd be about now," Ron Harper told reporters, "and that's leading the league in scoring and pulling away from the pack. He's removing every shadow of a doubt that he's the greatest player of all time." "Age-wise, I think I'm old," Jordan said on the issue, "but skill-wise, I think I'm still capable of playing the type of basketball I know I can play. The question people end up asking me the most is, how do I compare the two players, the one before baseball and the one after? Quite frankly, I think they are the same. It's just a matter of putting out the stats to show that they are the same. And I think by the end of the year, hopefully you will see that it's basically the same player with 2 years in between. Right now, I'm still being compared to Michael Jordan. And according to some people, I'm even failing to live up to Michael Jordan. But I have the best chance of being him because I am him. In the meantime, I'm improving and evolving." Next. The season also saw a wave of talented young players come into the league. None of them figured they needed to study Jordan on tape, LA shooting guard Brent Berry recalled, because they'd all spent their lives watching him on TV. But catching him in person was a different experience. Eddie Jones joined the Lakers that fall out of Temple. "When I saw Michael walk onto the court, it just excited me," he recalled. "I knew he was going to go after me. I knew whatever player he faced, he was definitely going to attack. When Michael went against somebody that was known as a defender, that ignited him. He just wanted to go out and take you out in the first quarter. That's just his competitiveness. He lived for that. He wanted to show you that. Hey, all these people are saying that you're a defender. I want to show you how well you defend." Jerry Stackhouse, a rookie out of North Carolina, learned that same lesson after boasting that he could hold his own against Jordan based on their summer showdowns back in Chapel Hill. "Nobody can stop me in this league, not even Michael Jordan," he told a reporter for a story in the morning papers in Philadelphia. That night, Jordan talked his way through 48 points and allowed Stackhouse a mere 9. "It was just very clinical," said Julius Erving, who was watching from the stands. Later that season, Jordan would score 53 against the league's hottest young star, Grant Hill, who was coached by Doug Collins. Collins immediately understood the difference between the two. "Grant is more inclined to want people to like him and to make people happy," Jordan's former coach observed. "Michael will cut your throat out." Chicago turned in a 12-2 record in November and 13-1 for December to begin 1996 with an astounding 25-3 record, and was in the midst of an 18-game winning streak after having run through a 12-game streak earlier. With each victory, speculation grew as to whether Chicago could win 70 games, breaking the all-time record for wins in a season set by the 1972 Los Angeles Lakers with a 69-13 finish. Jerry West, the Lakers' vice president for basketball operations, who was a star guard on that 72 club, said that only injuries could keep them from winning 70. "I look at the Celtics back in 86, back when they had Bill Walton and Kevin McHale coming off the bench," Jordan said, in trying to compare his team with others he had known. "Those guys were tough to deal with. Those guys played together for a long time. We're starting to learn how to play together, but those guys were together for a period of time. They knew arms, legs, and fingers and everything about each other. We're just learning fingers." It was pointed out to Jordan that most great NBA teams had a dominant low-post defender, someone to stop other teams in the paint. "We don't have that kind of animal," he admitted, "but I think Pippen compensates for that. I don't think any of those teams, other than maybe the 86 Boston Celtics, had a small forward that was as versatile on offense and defense as Scottie Pippen is." Meanwhile, Tex Winter had begun worrying that Rodman's focus on another rebounding title was tearing at the team fabric. Beyond that, Winter wondered whether Rodman really had a handle on his emotions. But with each game, each road trip, the former Piston seemed to find ways to relate better to his new teammates. "Dennis was different," Kerr remembered with a laugh. "Dennis wanted to be close to us. He just didn't always know how. He was just so shy. What ended up happening, The white guys ended up bonding with Dennis because of his love of Pearl Jam and the Smashing Pumpkins. We'd go to concerts with him. And in the end, Dennis felt a lot more comfortable around the white guys than he did around the black guys. We definitely felt comfortable around him and would go out with him once in a while, have a big night out, have a ton of fun. That was our way of bonding with him. Rodman bonded with Jordan and Pippen on the court as the Bulls evolved into a defensive force. What Rodman lacked in height, he made up for in strength as he lifted weights around the clock. It was hard for opponents to muscle him out of the post, which helped shore up Chicago inside, if other teams even managed to get inside. Bringing the ball up floor, the first thing opposing guards often encountered was Jordan at the top of the defense, bent low, his gaze fixed, telling them, "Come on, I'll give you a jump shot, shoot it. Oh, you don't want it?" As the season wore on, it became clear that many teams wanted absolutely nothing to do with Chicago. During their big start, the Bulls had toyed with opponents through the first two or three quarters before flexing their might and finishing strong. When they rolled through January at 14-0, Jackson began talking openly of resting players just to lose a few games and slow things down. He seemed worried that his team would get so drunk with winning during the regular season that their energy might be spent by the playoffs. "You can actually take them out of their rhythm by resting guys in a different rotation off the bench," he explained. "I have considered that." Jordan wanted no part of it. His focus was unbreakable. Fascinated by his play, Julius Erving sat down with him for a televised interview and asked about the shift in his approach as he aged. "Mentally, in the knowledge of basketball, I'm better," Jordan replied. "Physically, I may not have the same speed or quickness, but the mental can override the physical. I can't jump from the free throw line like I used to." "You seem to operate in a zone that seems to be reserved only for you," Erving told him. "What's it like when you're there, Mike?" "It's like every move, every step, every decision you make, it's the right decision," Jordan replied. Jordan was in the moment, as George Mumford described it. Every player could fall into his zone on occasion, but he now seemed to reside there. He had transformed his approach into a collection of post-up moves and mid-range jumpers that opponents struggled to defend. He became a post weapon, much like a great center who could attack consistently. He did this despite tendonitis in his knees that required ice before games and sometimes forced him to sit out practices. In mid-February, he scored 44 against the Pacers to go with Pippen's 40. Matt Gukas, doing color analysis for the game, pointed out that Elgin Baylor and Jerry West, two of the game's greatest scorers, had done that once or twice. More and more, Pippen and Jordan were becoming the perfect tandem. As Jordan went baseline repeatedly in just about every game that season, Gukas pointed out, it's one of the Jordan rules. You don't ever give Michael baseline. The Bulls juggernaut pushed through February at 11-3, and although March was interrupted by Rodman headbutting an official and getting suspended for six games, the Bulls still finished the month at 12-2. The 70-win season that Lacey Banks had predicted was beginning to seem possible. "What amazes me most about our team," said Jack Haley, "is that we probably have the league's greatest player ever in Michael Jordan. We have the league's greatest rebounder in Dennis Rodman, and we have what is probably this year's MVP in Scottie Pippen. And what amazes me most is the work ethic and leadership that these three guys bring to the floor night in and night out. With all of the accolades, with all of the money, with all of the championships, everything that they have, what motivates them besides winning another championship? How many months away is that? And these guys are focused now." Rodman marked his anticipation of the big event by showing up as a blonde, highlighted by a swirling red streak. Then, headed into the team's historic week, he opted for a flamingo pink shade. They earned win number 70 in Milwaukee on Tuesday, April 16th, and closed the regular season with a road win in Washington for a 72-10 finish. The Miami Heat fell in the first round of the playoffs in three quick games. Next came a grunting rematch with the Knicks, who managed an overtime win at home about which Jordan was nonchalant. He scored 35 in Game 5 in Chicago to finish them off 4-1. After one late bucket, he backed down the floor and waved bye-bye to Knicks fan Spike Lee, sitting courtside with a towel wrapped around his shoulders. "I've always been known as a player who could finish off a team," Jordan said afterward. To prepare the team for Orlando, Jackson spliced shots of Pulp Fiction, the story of two hired assassins, into the scouting tapes of the Magic. His players got the clear message. Rodman held Horace Grant scoreless for 28 minutes of Game 1, until the Orlando forward injured his shoulder in the third quarter and was lost for the year. The meeting of the two best teams in the league ended 121-83, a 38-point humiliation for Orlando. Commissioner David Stern had presented Jordan with the league MVP trophy before the game. "You still set the standard for greatness, determination, and leadership," he told him. They were behind by 18 at halftime in Game 2 when Jackson walked into the locker room and told his team they had the magic just where they wanted them. Indeed, the Bulls had toyed with opponents all season. They won going away as the once powerful Magic headed into a slide. "Guys like Michael and Scotty, when there's blood in the water, they can smell it," Kerr told a reporter afterward. "They're ready for the kill." The strangest sight of the conference finals was Rodman defending the massive Shaquille O'Neal straight up, loading the big center on his thigh and hoisting him off the block. Sitting courtside, working as a scout, Brendan Malone marveled at what Rodman had brought to the Bulls and how Jordan had adapted his game. Orlando fell in four straight, an exclamation mark on Jordan's response to his failures a year earlier. "He's the baddest dude to ever lace up a pair of sneakers," Orlando's Nick Anderson said of Jordan after he scored 45 points in Game 4 to complete the sweep. Dr. Jack Ramsey, the former coach turned analyst, pointed out that the Bulls star had done it by immersing himself within the team. Seattle. The Bulls fidgeted through a nine-day layoff waiting for Seattle to advance in the West. The 1996 NBA Finals opened on June 5th, with the Bulls listed as 10-1 favorites to defeat the Sonics, who had won an impressive 64 games during the regular season. The only anxiety that Jordan felt was the approach of Father's Day. He was mindful that the last time he was in the championship series 3 years earlier, his family, including his father, had celebrated the title in his Phoenix hotel room. As this next milestone approached, the family now showed signs of fracture, although his mother still made an effort to support him. On the eve of the series, Princess Di visited Chicago for a medical fundraiser at the Field Museum of Natural History. Dolores Jordan, a serious Diana fan, was confounded by the conflicting events. She wanted to attend the candlelit evening of dinner and dancing, so she slipped into an evening gown and attended the dinner with the princess. Then, changed clothes and dashed across town to watch her son. "I know Michael expects me to be there," she explained. The NBA had credentialed approximately 1,600 journalists from around the globe to cover the event. The whole world would be watching, as was usually the case for Jordan's performances, particularly now that his new sidekick, Rodman, had yet another hairdo, with various red, green, and blue hieroglyphics and symbols scrambled on his skull. Reporters asked Jordan if he could still take flight and launch the dunks that made him famous, now that his game consisted largely of post-ups and jumpers. "Can I still take off? I don't know," he said. "I haven't been able to try it because defenses don't guard me one-on-one anymore. But honestly, I probably can't do it. I like not knowing whether I can do it because that way, I still think I can. As long as I believe I can do something, that's all that matters." Seattle coach George Karl had hired Brendan Malone to scout the Bulls during the playoffs in hopes that he could help them employ the infamous Jordan rules for the series. As the finals were set to open, Malone and Chuck Daly encountered Jordan in a hallway in the arena. "Michael came walking by me," Malone recalled in a 2011 interview. "He was upset because I had come with the knowledge of how to try and defend him." "You're not going to beat me," he told Malone sharply. "He was ticked off," Malone recalled. "Chuck looked at me and said, 'You've got him upset.'" "You have to try to match their intensity," Malone told reporters at the time. "Forget X's and O's. They are going to try and cut your heart out right away, right from the first quarter." He was both right and wrong. Jordan would certainly attack, but the outcome was also about matchups. George Karl had 6'10 Detlef Schrempf cover Jordan to open the series, with the idea that as soon as he dropped into the post, guard Hersey Hawkins would immediately double-team. It was a huge mistake. Jordan scored 28 points, and there was plenty of balance as Pippen scored 21, Kukoc 18, Harper 15, and Longley 14. Karl later shifted Gary Payton, the NBA's Defensive Player of the Year, to cover Jordan, but it was too late. In the fourth quarter, the Bulls' defense forced 7 turnovers, and Kukoc came alive with 10 points in what had become a typical Chicago finish. They took the advantage, 107-90. Chicago shot 39% in Game 2, but that just meant more rebounds for Rodman. He finished with 20 boards, including a record-tying 11 offensive rebounds. Jordan struggled, but willed in 29 points, and the defense forced another 20 Sonics turnovers, including a batch during a 3-minute stretch of the third period when Chicago pushed the margin from 66-64 to 76-65. Jordan had grown furious with Kukoc for passing up shots. "Are you scared?" he taunted Kukoc. "If you are, then sit down. If you're out here to shoot, then shoot." Kukoc hit two trays, and Jordan rewarded him moments later with a pass for a slam, and the Bulls took the second game 92-88. With Harper's knee hurting, Jackson and Winter figured they were in for a fight with the next three games in Seattle's key arena. But the Sonics were strangely subdued for Game 3. With Kukoc starting for Harper, the Bulls were vulnerable defensively, but they forced the issue on offense from the opening tip. With Jordan scoring 12 points, the Bulls leaped to a 34-12 lead by the end of the first quarter. By halftime, the lead had stretched to 62-38. Jordan finished with 36, but the big surprise was 19 from Longley, who had struggled in Game 2. Asked what had turned the big center's game around, Jackson replied, "Verbal bashing by everybody on the club. I don't think anybody's ever been attacked by as many people as Luke after Friday's game. Tex gave him an earful, and Michael did too. I tried the last few days to build his confidence back up." Chicago sat poised for a sweep, what would have been a 15-1 run through the playoffs, the most successful postseason record in NBA history. The next 2 days of practice took on the air of a coronation, with the media hustling to find comparisons between the Bulls and pro basketball's great teams from the past. ESPN analyst Jack Ramsey said the Bulls just might be the greatest defensive team of all time. "The best defenders in the game are Pippen and Jordan," he said. "They're just so tough. In each playoff series, they take away one more thing from the opponent, and then you're left standing out there naked without a stitch of clothes. It's embarrassing." "The key to the Bulls' drive was Jordan," Ramsey added. "He is such a fierce competitor that he brings everybody beyond their individual levels. I watched Steve Kerr, who had the reputation of being a no-defense guy, a good spot-up shooter. Now you watch him, he's out there playing defense, challenging everybody that he plays. He's right in their face. He may get beaten, but he's not going to back down from the chore. He now puts the ball on the floor and creates his own shot. That's something he never did before. Michael's influence on all those players is tremendous." It was before Game 4 that George Karl, who had also played for Dean Smith at Carolina, realized he hadn't done enough to rattle Jordan. So he arranged for Tassie Dempsey, who had cooked for Tar Heels basketball players for 30 years, to fly to Seattle to cheer on the Sonics. Jordan was shocked to see her that Thursday before the game and asked her, "Mama D, what are you doing here?" "I came to cheer for George," she replied. Carl's wife told a disbelieving Jordan, "Michael, Mama D's our good luck symbol." The always superstitious Jordan told her, "Then you're going home, Mama D. If you're bringing them luck, you've got to go home." Gary Payton proved to be a bigger problem for MJ than Mama D. Payton had spent much of the series guarding Pippen, but Carl saw that he was effective on Jordan in parts of Game 3, so he switched Payton over to cover more of Jordan in Game 4. Ron Harper was struggling with painful tendonitis, which meant that Jordan spent more time covering Payton. Chicago suddenly lacked the vital ball pressure that was so key to its defense. Without Harper, Jordan and Pippen couldn't roam to create havoc. The Sonics settled the outcome with a second quarter blitz from which Chicago never recovered. Frustrated by Payton's defense, Jordan furiously berated both his teammates and the officials. Midway through the fourth quarter, Jordan was called for a double dribble. He flashed his anger again and stomped his foot, obviously rattled. He left the game minutes later, having hit just 6 of 19, and barked furiously from the bench in the closing minutes, with Pippen laughing, squeezing his shoulder. Payton had done the job, and Seattle fans were left to wonder what might have changed if Payton had spent more time on Jordan earlier in the series. Harper sat again in Game 5. Given a second chance to close out the series, the Bulls struggled, fell behind, then closed the gap, only to fall a second time, 89-78. The series miraculously was returning to Chicago. "The joy of six," the Seattle newspapers declared the next day in a headline. Jordan was livid about the failure to close it out. Backup center James Edwards had taken to dropping by Jordan's room during the playoffs to have a post-game cigar with Ahmad Rashad and Jordan, who always had an attaché case filled with the finest smokes. "There was usually something interesting going on there," Edwards recalled. "But when he stopped in after Game 5, he was startled at Jordan's fury. I had never seen him that upset before," he kept saying. "We should have won today. It should be over. I told him we would get it when we got home. He didn't want to hear that at all. He kept saying, it should be over." He was ending the year just as he had opened it, with his harshest emotions on display. He had wanted to end the series as soon as possible, to unburden himself of the immense pressure he had shouldered since deciding to return. The championship showdown had not been his best performance. He had shot 41.5% from the field and would average 27.3 points for the series, well below the 36 points he was averaging during the playoffs. But there was another reason for his anger and disappointment. He had wanted to end it before Father's Day. "He's always on my mind," he said. That Sunday was Game 6, Father's Day. He felt the rush of emotion and chose to dedicate the game to his father's memory. The United Center crowd thundered at every turn that afternoon, with prolonged applause during introductions. The sound waves seemed to compress, then explode, when announcer Ray Clay got to, "From North Carolina." Taking all this in, the Sonics stood courtside, chomping their gum and setting their jaws. The audience exploded again moments after the tip-off, when Pippen went to the hoop with an underhand scoop to open the scoring. With Harper back, the Bulls' pressure returned, and they picked the Sonics clean time and again. Harper would play 38 minutes. Every time he paused, an assistant trainer would coat his knee with a spray anesthetic. Inspired by his presence, Pippen pushed the Bulls out of the gate in the first period with 7 points and two steals, giving Chicago a 16-12 lead. To settle the matter, the Bulls produced a 19-9 run in the third period, capped by Pippen dishing on the break to Rodman, who flipped in a little reverse shot, then thrust his fists skyward, bringing yet another outburst from the building, which got louder yet when he made the free throw for a 62-47 lead. Jackson had left Jordan on the bench for a long stretch at the end of the third, so that he would be fresh for the kill in the fourth. But with Jordan an emotional wreck and facing double teams, at least some of the momentum would come from Kukoc, who canned a three from the corner to push it to 70-58. Kerr followed with another three with 2:44 to go, and the entire building seemed to be dancing to "Whoomp, there it is." Pippen's final tray on a kickout from Jordan came at 57 seconds. Moments later, for the last possession of this very historic season, Jordan dribbled near midcourt, then relinquished it to Pippen for one last delirious air ball. Jordan broke loose from Jackson's embrace to join a mad scrum for the game ball. He tumbled briefly to the floor with Randy Brown. Then he was gone, the game ball clutched behind his head, disappearing into the locker room, trying to escape the NBC cameras, searching for haven in the trainer's room, weeping there on the floor in joy and pain over his memories on Father's Day. "I'm sorry I was away for 18 months," he said after being named Finals MVP. "I'm happy I'm back, and I'm happy to bring a championship back to Chicago." The players then jumped up on the courtside press table for a victory jig to acknowledge the fans, just as they had in 1992, the last time they had won in Chicago. With them was Rodman, already shirtless. "I think we can consider ourselves the greatest team of all time," Pippen said with satisfaction. "This is the 90s, but they play with a learned mentality from an earlier time," George Karl said. "This is an old-time package. I don't know about the Bird era or the Magic era. They were great teams, but this Bulls team has that same basic mentality. I like their heart, and I like their philosophy." In the euphoria of a championship moment, athletes and coaches tend to favor restraint. Why promise another championship and bring on the debilitating pressure? Why not bask in the accomplishment, especially if you've just delivered arguably the greatest season in the history of the game? But that had never been Jordan's way. 5 is the next number, he said with the same sort of smile that had once so disarmed Sonny Vaccaro. Chapter 34, The Reckoning. Having fought his way back to the top, Jordan's time now came around to free agency and the opportunity to rectify the great discrepancy between his salary and those of other top players in the league. With the Bulls, contract negotiations often left tempers flaring and people taking offense. Wealth and fame didn't make any of them immune to getting their feelings hurt. Just the opposite, actually. The bigger the ego, the deeper the bruise. "The summertime is when all that stuff erupts with Michael," Steve Kerr observed at the time. "We win the championship, and he goes to the podium and makes his plea for another crack at it. That infuriated management," Kerr said. "Then it goes on all summer." Reinsdorf and Jordan had always enjoyed what appeared to be a strong relationship. As player salaries skyrocketed in the 1990s, Jordan was said to be understandably bothered that his contract paid him in the range of $4 million annually, while a dozen or more lesser players in the league earned twice that. At the same time, he was far too